Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us once again on the Delco Young Democast. My name is Mike DeEva. It is awesome to talk to you again. Today, we have another one of our bonus episodes, so to speak, our fireside chats. If anybody doesn't get that reference, and I sincerely hope you do, I would just Google it and see what comes up. It's a great part of history. Anyway, today we are going to listen to the conversation that Manda Hammack and Gina Amoroso and I had with Drew McGinty, who is running for the 7th District for the U.S. House of Representatives here in Pennsylvania. We had this talk with Drew before the two big pieces of news came out about the district being redrawn with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's gerrymandering decision and with Pat Meehan's love letter. So we don't touch on either of those in this conversation. This is going back almost a week, but it was still a really great conversation. So take a listen and hope you enjoy. Mr. Drew McGinty is a lifelong Pennsylvanian who worked his way through college, receiving his bachelor's in computer science from LaSalle University and his master's degree in information systems from Drexel University. He's been an IT professional in the healthcare, pharmaceutical, and finance industries for 30 years. He's running for the Democratic nomination for U.S. House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 7th District, which includes large portions of Delaware County. Drew McGinty, welcome to the Delco Young Democast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, yeah, we like to start just with some of the basics. You know, where did you grow up? What was your family like?
Okay. I grew up in Jenkintown, Montgomery County. I lived in Montgomery County my entire life until about 2 years ago. I moved to South Philadelphia when I remarried. I grew up, my father was a career Navy. Fortunately, he did not travel much. He was stationed out of the Philadelphia Navy Yard, which is really no longer there from a military perspective. He spent 20 years on the job as a special agent with NCIS, was at that time was called Naval Investigative Service. Okay. So he was in. We come from a law enforcement upbringing as well. Later on, he went to continue on with the intelligence community after that, but got away from the kind of a police detective role and wanted something more 9-to-5. And my mother was a homemaker. I have a younger brother and a sister who still live in Montgomery County, too, and as well as my mom. I went to Jenkintown High School from kindergarten to 12th grade. My best friends are pretty much the people I've known since I was about 5 years old. So it's a very small, tight-knit community. Really very close to really more less of schoolmates and more of like an extended family. But that was in a nutshell my upbringing.
So with your father being in the military, I'm not sure if he was able to be sort of like outwardly politically active, but you know, were there like dinner table conversations at the very least?
No. And that was politics was off limits basically. And it's very common, especially in the military and law enforcement too. They hold the views, but they're rarely public about that. And even now, that holds true mostly through law enforcement. You rarely hear that. And it's only when they retire can they sometimes speak out.
So what was kind of like the specific moment where you connected with politics then, if it wasn't sort of like a dinner table conversation?
Where I connected with politics, that's a good question. I hadn't been asked that before, and I like to be challenged. My line of work. So I say IT, information technology, but over the last 15 plus years, mine has been mostly a job of politics and business wise. So when I run very large global programs, you have to deal with a lot of different people from around actually the world now, and you have to get them all focused on what the objectives are. And that's pure politics. You have to get there and say, here's where we need to go. You have to work with each group. And give a sense of that is where I now mostly work with very senior people in large companies. You have to still work with people in the front lines. And it's interesting, the discussions I will have, they'll say, well, say a vice president might say, well, we need to do this. Well, I'll say, let me talk to your frontline people, maybe your coders or whatever it might be. See, and then why? And they say, well, if they don't want to do it, it's not going to get done. So you have to look at all levels across all the board, and everybody has something that you have to understand what's in it for them, and try to give everybody a little bit of what they need and a little bit of what they want, and in order to make things go. So that kind of from business. And I took that and I said, okay, I've learned a lot. And I went in, I did about 10 years with volunteer work with peacemaking and economic development work with Northern Ireland.
Oh, excellent.
Mostly on this side of the Atlantic, but still a lot of, I'll say, distrust, bigotry, things like that from future generations. It's almost, I call it generational bigotry. You know, it just hands down from one to another. And coming... And on both on all sides of the debate there. So I said, I'm going to try to apply that same my same skills to that. And we had, for those 10 years, it was a challenge getting a group of people to work together and finding new and creative ways was always the objective because you had to find out, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. This didn't work. Let's try that. Until you hit on a formula that got people working together. And that always starts with... dialogue and being willing and able to speak with people who maybe not agree with you. That turned into the victory of Mr. Trump. And when after that occurred, I wasn't very I voted and but I wasn't politically active. But up until he was running, I was involved with the Irish American Democrats. Campaigning here in Delaware County on behalf of the Irish American Democrats and Hillary Secretary Clinton. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, in my opinion. I mean, I had been very tired of all the partisan, highly polarized politics and issue on both sides. And things when that happens, I know things don't get done. Good things can't get done. If that's the way things are working. So I said, I could do this. I can do this. And I don't think many people across the country at all levels are first-time candidates, from supervisors all the way up through members of Congress like us running for starting this year. And actually starting last year, where you had two Democrats, first-time candidates running and actually won. So there's a change coming. I hope it's I want to be part of that change. I am, and that's my passion, that we kind of start a new wave and that is not just blue, but just is one more that's about working together with everybody. Whether you disagree or not, that doesn't matter. You can always find common ground, I've learned, and work together and really help Americans.
It's kind of funny because that was the next question. As a first-time candidate, which you are, you mentioned what specifically led you to running for office. So what I will ask is, why the 7th?
Why the 7th? So the 7th, I looked at the races coming up, and I saw really what would be feasible and really crossed over into Montgomery County, which are basically the 7th, 8th, and 6th. And I looked at, what could I do? Where I'm located right now is just a few minutes from the Delaware County line. So 7th District is right nearby. So I feel it's important to be out there and working with people and meeting the people and listening to them. Like I just came back from a worship service here over at St. James United Church of Christ. Okay. I go on and do that on a regular basis, go all different faith communities as part of what I feel is necessary to understand the people in the so it gives me that, and since it's so gerrymandered and distance and traffic and things like that, to me it's important to be somewhere close. But I also looked at the folks. So I thought the 6th district was a little too far away to really give that kind of attention. I looked at the 8th and the 7th, and I said, okay, who are the worst offenders? In terms of not working with the other side, and I see some. And I went and I looked at Patrick Meehan's voting record as well as his behavior. So to me, I'm judging. I pick the people based on those two factors. So the voting record is atrocious. Okay, and for Mr. Meehan, and I also looked at his behavior. He hasn't been to a town hall, or he hasn't had a town hall in over 1,800 days. I was actually at an event recently in media where he was invited to attend, and he wouldn't give an answer one way or another, and it was like, well, that's just rude, and you know, that's just being very disrespectful for the people who voted him in the into office. He's not representing them. And I found those are just some examples, but I looked at Mr. Meehan's record, and I think it's cowardly. His behavior is cowardly. There are some Republicans in Congress that, while I don't agree with anything they have, any positions on anything, I have to admire if they got it out in front of their constituency and were being raked over the coals, yelled at by people in a room, that they stood there and listened and gave their side of the story. To me, I may not agree with anything, but I can respect courage. I can respect people, you know, sticking with their principles and not waffling back and forth, whether I agree with them or not. Actually, that's somebody I found in my history that you can work with somebody like that more so than somebody like Mr. Meehan, who is one thing. I call him the chameleon. He's one thing, one thing to one person one second, and he switches color, and he's somebody else the second. You can't work with people like that. They're people that can't negotiate and compromise. So to me, I picked him because I compared him with Brian Fitzpatrick, where he has some been across the aisle. He has signed the commitment to civility pledge. He has done some things that says, okay, we're going to work with the other side. And to me, that's the most important thing, is to work together across the aisle.
We talked a little bit about, you know, agreeing with positions and whatnot. You've described yourself as a moderate Democrat. What exactly does that mean to you?
It's interesting. What it means to me is going to be different from what it means to a lot of people. And also it's a generational thing as well. So moderate means, from my perspective, is while certainly my positions where I feel on the issues are liberal, always have been, the focus is on moderation. So versus what needs to be done is the where I'm very liberal in that perspective. How you get it done, I'm moderate. Meaning it's you have to be willing and able to negotiate and compromise. You have to be able to reach across the aisle. Whether the other side is going to be receptive or not, you have to try. I oppose any extreme behavior or rhetoric, because it never helps to get what you – and it's really – and I know through experience, business and my volunteer experience – getting to your goals is never a straight line. It's always, but you always have to keep making forward progress, and it always comes as small incremental wins. If you focus on small incremental wins, you ultimately get to your objective, and also, but there'll be setbacks along the way. But you have to try, and you have to keep moving at it. So that's meaning moderate is being able to, and also listen to the other side. So. There's not enough listening. I just recently signed a pledge, a commitment to dialogue pledge, with a Republican candidate in the Texas 21st District. There's 18 now, or maybe 17 Republican candidates for the primary. But he stood out, and I reached out to him, and I said, we agreed on a lot of things. And I said, let's commit to have that dialogue along the ideas of a commitment to civility, but take it a step further. Focus on something meaningful and also something we can actually do. You know, and so we have regular phone calls. And actually, a week from tomorrow, we're gonna make our first call available for anybody who wants to call in and listen. So we're gonna talk about universal health care as the topic of that call. It's 30 minutes, and we'll say we just went. And the idea is, you explain your side, I'll explain my position. Let's find out three things. One is, where do we agree? Where do we have common ground? Where is there might be some area from negotiation and compromise? And where do we disagree? And that's it. So where we disagree, let's put that, the idea is to put that off to the side, and let's focus on the things we can agree with. And let's get some positive change going. Now, we're not elected yet, but we want to demonstrate this is the way your representatives, regardless of which party, should be behaving and should be acting.
Yeah, we would love to have the information for that, so we can put it up on our website and all that. So that
the details will be coming out tonight with a call-in number. It'll be a webcast plus a call-in number still.
Excellent.
So a lot of the grassroots activity in the party right now is coming from progressives, especially young progressives. Do you think a moderate message is capable of breaking through and being successful in 2018?
The answer is yes to the latter part of the question. Yes, it is going to be successful. In terms of younger progressives, people who self, and I call it self-identify as progressive, and I usually refer to it as a capital P, which is interesting because I have always considered myself progressive with a lowercase p. Coming from a military family, law enforcement family, my family was very progressive for that time. So, you know, we had African-Americans who came to our house, which was unheard of in that time. And it was friends. It was my dad's, you know, one of his people he worked with. So, you know, it was, we were very progressive at the time. It's kind of taken a new meaning, I guess, even since the days of Ross Perot, I don't know, early 90s, you know, heard about him.
Right on the edge.
So we had a, you know, Ross Perot at that time in the early 90s really hit, and I would have voted for him if he'd stayed in the election. He hit that, he was very socially conscious, but fiscally responsible, and against the way they'd always, politics have always been done. He gained a lot of traction. There was a good chance he was going to win that election if he hadn't dropped out. So the will it reach out to them? I don't know. I'm hoping it will. I think it's the right message. I think, and I, when I talk to older voters, okay, who not necessarily identify as progressive, but just, you know, you're like the silent majority of people just going about their day to day and not as actively engaged with politics, that message strikes home. It really strikes home because they've learned that that's really they, and especially even those who are older than me. So, I'll, you know, I'm only 55, but you look at the, and I've been called a Truman Democrat and others been called, or an Eisenhower Republican. There's a time in politics before the 80s came around where actually there was a lot of disagreement, but people got things, a lot of good things done for the people of this country. And so the older folks see that. It's like, wow, you sound like a one like that from that age. And I said, well, maybe, you know, it's like maybe I was that in the previous life. I don't know. Maybe it was one of both. Who knows? But I think from the younger voters, I think it's tough. I know I'm not as popular, certainly, with the progressives, younger progressives, and even across the line. But I'm true to my, I am who I am. I know my approach works. I will not waver from my approach. And I do not, one thing at the beginning, I say I will never pander, ever. I'll give you an example. I was in a meeting where we're going along with some of my primary opponents, and there was a forum, Delco Indivisible. Maybe some of you were there. The question was, do you support universal, or was it Medicare for all or single payer? And I was like, no. And I explained why. And that was off message because I've had 22 years in healthcare industry experience. I know what the problems are there, how big the, how complex. Yes. So to me, my idea is, being pragmatic is not always popular, but it gets things done. And to me, I'm hoping people see that message. And, you know, even if Democrats win, and I've told several people this privately, even if the Democrats win, Republicans don't go away. They're still there. So we need to be working with them. And really, if we're going to get things done that we would like to get done, we're going to need to be able to work with the other side. That's the bottom line. And yeah, it won't be everything that we need to get done or we would like to get done. It won't be right away. But if we kept pushing and being tenacious and over year after year after year, it will get better. And if I look at, and this is the when I'll go, I'll wrap it up here. I look at when I hear about issues from about the minorities and African Americans in particular, and I look at when I was growing up and kind of the de facto segregation. We've come light years by, and mostly with Democrats pushing. It didn't happen overnight, but you just keep going. You keep, and yeah, you have some setbacks and things that happen, but you have to get back. You have to stand back up. You have to keep going. And the more you make it, the more we are willing to negotiate and compromise, reach across the aisle. And as Michelle Obama said, I love what she said about when they go low, we go high. And I'm not even just talking about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking even within Democrats. We have to always go the high route. And we have to be the ones that are going to reach out and help get these things and move forward.
Yeah. So you would kind of say, you know, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. You know, if you look at when it, frequently in business, they call me in because I'm a experienced person with over 30 years professional experience. We wanted this fixed in 6 months. I'm like, no, this took, that's not going to happen. This took years to break. Okay. Yeah. So what we want to do is, my first goal is we want to have a win, a small victory with everybody who's on board in 6 weeks, minimum, maximum 3 months. Have a win. Let's get a win done. And then what I've seen it every time, and people like always doubt it in the beginning, but if they see it over a couple of years, they say, wow, wins will start to incrementally grow as you approach it the way I'm talking about approaching, in a pragmatic, open, honest, respectful way with the other side. They don't have to, you know, it's, again, it all starts with just going and talking with people like I do. I'll go to VFW events and all sorts of American Legion events where most of the folks are not or Republicans and or maybe more aligned that way. But, you know, when you get over there and you reach across and you start having, you know, to sit down and talk with people, it's amazing how much progress you can make. Out of those 200, I've been at 200, more than 200. And I didn't realize this till a few weeks ago. My campaign team counted it all up. Non-political events. Which I try to focus on non-political events versus political events. Mm-hmm. Out there, over 200 since I started last January. And you get out there and you just sit down, you just talk with people, you go to festivals and you just go place to place. Tell me about your business. Let me hear about your volunteer group. Let me go sit in the worship service. Let me hear about what you're doing, what you're talking about in a day-to-day basis. So you get to understand what the people of the district really want and what they need, and that's the way to start. And somebody has to be the first to cross the line, like reach across the fence.
The Republican side of the ballot in this race has raised something like $2.5 million or something like that, and you know, not to mince words, you're well behind that.
I'm at the lowest money raising so far, and I'm proud of that, actually.
Well, I mean, yeah, you had just announced recently that you're not going to be taking any corporate PAC money. You know, how big of a concern is the potential spending gap for this race?
So I have two races I'm fighting. My first race is the primary. Okay, so from a primary perspective, some of my opponents are touting how much money they raise at these discussions, which kind of confuses me, since they're also self-described progressives. So I am about raising as little money as possible to get my name out as possible. So how do you do that for the primary? And that is just through hard work and out there every day and going to every possible event you can possibly go to and meeting people and talking with them and learning about them. So to me, that's the goal. I'm hoping, you know, from a primary perspective, I don't see money should be the issue or at all. But maybe a little naive, but I'm a realist. And I said, I'm going to have to supplement by, it's hard to raise. Let's put it this way. People said, I was at a group event, say, how do we energize moderates? The middle, it's like, that I don't think you do. You know, they're not people that are, you know, you easily get. They're the, you know, they're not people you generally get the rally behind you. So, but they're probably the majority of the folks out there, and on any side. And so the thing is, to me, is to go out and meet, and through hard work, I have a good volunteer team. I think it's the largest volunteer team. I will not, and I've looked at all the money that's being spent, even in primaries, and what they spend it on, and I don't see that. How is that going to make that person a better representative if you're spending money on consultants and things like that? I don't, and survey. So I focus on that, getting out and meeting the people with the primary. So my fervent, assuming I do win the primary, then my wish is that all the Democrats will get behind and we can fight against Mr. Meehan's war chest. Okay, so yeah, so to me, I see it as a two-pronged attack battle from my perspective, is really getting my message out. And why am I different? Why am I the right choice? And really, if you look at the Democrats' record in the district, we've only won the district 2 out of the last 15 elections. That's out of the last 30 years. Okay, and that was by one person, a moderate, a retired admiral. Okay, so who did a lot of. I said that makes sense. When I read about his campaign before I started, I was like, wow, that's what I would do. And he got out there. Maybe he had, I don't look at the money, but that's the thing. He did a walk across the district. You know, he got to know everybody on all sides. And to me, that's the way to win. Because if you don't win the general, we can't get things that we want done. Yeah. That's the bottom line. So is it? So to me, it's about being moderate. And because you have to get 17% of the Republicans to cross over and vote for the Democratic candidate. That's it. If you don't get that, look at it. We've only done that 87% of the time in the last 30 years. So it's not, you know, I'm sorry. The inverse. No. Strike that. No, the inverse. We've only been successful 13% of the time. And that's not good enough. We have to do better. And it's not about gerrymandering. I heard that. It's always gerrymandered. That's not the point. In business and anything else in life, if you get obstacles, you find a new and creative way to get around it, and you fight harder and work harder. So to me, that's not an excuse to me. So you have to, if it were for people in business or even individuals, everybody would be out of work because you always have somebody wants your job or would take your job. You have to always show that, you know, you have to be, you're the person they want and you're worth the money they're spending on you.
So my next question is, my husband's a disabled vet, so this kind of hits home for me. Your wife, Lisa, is a physician with the Veterans Administration, and we have a large military and veteran community in Delaware County. What do you think of the way the veterans and military members as a whole are being used by the current administration as kind of pawn pieces, so to speak?
I agree that they're using the veterans as, and it's an easy thing for some of the folks to do, to kind of actually misuse them in that regard. So from everything I know about the Veterans Administration, there have, over the years, there maybe since the last 10 years, there's been a lot of improvements. But I certainly see, and I talked to just not my wife, but others as well, there needs to be a lot of improvements. I've recently went to a women's veterans groups. There's one in Philadelphia. I attended their holiday party. I actually walked in, and there were some people that I used to work with at Independence Blue Cross that were there. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know you were the retired. Oh, yeah. One woman challenged me, do you remember my name? And I said, it took 3 seconds, but I remembered her name. So, but, you know, and I sat down and listened to and heard about all the issues, especially with women veterans. So, and also I've talked to some professionals who deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder as well. And I learned a lot about things that aren't really talked about in the press or anything. And usually the veterans don't talk about it. So we've made a lot of progress, I think, over time. But using this as a pawn is despicable to me. We really should be understanding it more. The problems more. Like, I'm trying at least as far as I can understand the problem so I can, and from what I could see, I think some of the things we need to look at better efficiencies. We need to look at being more open-minded to a lot of the issues with like women and LGBT communities and all that. We have to really look deep and really say, we need to do more for this and to better deliver the services. And we need to deliver them faster. And so to me, the military budget, if you want to keep the military budget as high as some do, then let's divert a lot of it to the veterans that are coming, especially, and get them right when they're coming back from duty, right when they come back from duty. Don't make it onerous. Don't make it a problem. Give them the proper mental health services that they required. Give them, and maybe it's, and I don't know for, but I hear about the high level of opioid addiction that happens when returning from coming back from service immediately. So there's a lot of things that still need to be done, and we just need to be compassionate and caring, and we have to put our money into it, and really, but just not as superficial. We have to really dig down into the root causes of the problems and the things that they're not getting and fix it. That's it. Just fix it.
You've spent a large portion of your career working in the healthcare and pharmaceutical industries. From that experience, what do you think is the most glaring issue that needs to be fixed in the healthcare system?
I wish it could be that simple. The glaring issues. There's so many. It's blinding. Really, there are three major parts the healthcare system. It's and we it, frequently people talk about the payment process, which is very disjointed and problematic. Also, we the second part is delivery of our healthcare system. That is extremely inefficient and oftentimes ineffective. One case is Medicaid. We deliver Medicaid in this country differently from Medicare, and we have 50 different states involved with the Medicaid. So the you have the inefficiencies. Then you have the utilization. Okay, so ideally you want to keep utilization low. You want people to be healthy. Okay, you don't want to necessarily you want to help them certainly when they get better if they become sick, but you want to do everything you possibly can to make sure that they don't get sick. And that usually starts with early health care, but also early good nutrition and good education. Those are the three areas we need to do. Because, if we focus on those three areas, and it's not one, you solve one, you solve the other. They're all interdependent. You have to look at them. And the ACA did that. And yes, there was a great progress. It was but the first step. There's a lot of improvement that are needed, lots and lots of improvements. But it was a good first step that actually worked and made tens of millions of people's lives better. So we need to go along that. So glaring is, I think, a few things in getting the issues. I mean, at a high level, I just talked about that. But I wanted to give you an example. So inefficiencies. I mean, we have... the health systems, they buy equipment and it's underutilized. So they don't, there's a lot of things there. We have 50 state governments, okay, and state legislatures, okay, all with different rules. Pennsylvania is very challenging with doctors in terms of but every state has their own different set of rules. How do you keep track of all that related to medical delivery? Each state has 50, we have 50 health departments. You have 50 insurance departments. The complexity you can just see across the board is there. So I don't think there's any glaring. It's at the core foundation, it is broken. But we had that light of hope. So there's always hope. To me, the ACA was that first step. And to me, people ask, well, what are some of the first things that you would do when getting in the office? I say, well, if we still have the current president, then hopefully the Democrats take one or both houses, we at least can stop the degradation of the ACA. We can protect it and fight in every way we can to stop them from at least protecting it, because it may take some time before we can even get back to where we were on this subject, but we have to stop further, and then we're going to have to sit down and work with the other side and improve and keep moving forward. If you look at it from both sides, it has healthcare is at the root of so many things in our and everybody, just not in the country, in our lives.
Absolutely.
If you're healthy, you can work. If you're not worried about if your parents or loved ones are healthy, you don't have to worry about them. There's, if we could address so many things, and I talk about utilization or prevention. If we can get to at the youngest ages, talk about and get more nationwide programs on. Addiction, and how do we change the culture? Let's not even start taking any kind of drugs, or like we did with cigarettes. How many young people don't smoke now? We have to address these, and that's a utilization thing. The less people smoke, the less we utilize the medical services. So there's so much, but right now we only have to be worried about stopping the degradation. Unfortunately, that's our first job in 2018, or hopefully starting in January 2019.
Under the Trump administration and the Republican stronghold in both the House and the Senate, women's access to reproductive rights and their right to choose is constantly under attack. Even here in Pennsylvania, with our legislator being both supermajorities in both our own House and State Senate, can women count on you to be an advocate for us in D.C. and our reproductive rights and our rights to choose?
Oh, absolutely. So. There's some things that are, when I said earlier, negotiating compromise, there are some things that are not open for compromise. They're basic principles, like nobody has a right to legislate how a woman does anything in regards to health care with her body. That's it. Bottom line. Roe versus Wade should stand. And now at the same time, I'll say that, there's no negotiation with me on that. But at the same time, when I ask people, somebody's I'll get questions and I'll say, people who are, self-identify as pro-life or anti-abortion, whether they need a seat at the table. We need to sit down and that's the one issue, and I talked about it, the 3 points, the ones that we will never get agreement on. That'll be it. But as the studies data shows, especially from the 1990s when it was first being done, that the more women have good jobs, so the thing is to reduce, if your share, I think abortion is must be, and I'm not a woman, I can't know for sure, must be such a horrible decision to even have to be having to take, okay? So we need to make it better for them to have to, and we need to understand it and give them all the information they need and let them know their choices. We also have, but we also, many of us want to reduce that possibility of happening. So what? How do you do that? Data shows it. You better jobs, pay equity, more, the better wages women have, the less likely they'll come to that decision. Healthcare, sex education, education was, especially for children and more you have, not just men and women, just not women, just boys too. Like, you know, better health. So education, all these things that we can do that have been proven time and again, and with the data to show it, these studies, that the more we do this, we can come to, if we can work with the other side and those who are not pro-choice, then, you know, we can try to get that number down. But there'll always be that number that at the end of the day, they have to make that decision. That's their decision to make. It shouldn't be illegal. And we need to support them in that, both from a variety of, you know, just not for the health care, the actual health care, but emotionally as a society. And I can't imagine having to make that decision one way or another. I don't think it's a, I don't know, but I always think of that. That's a no-win decision for a woman. You know, you make the decision. And maybe I'm wrong, but you know, I can't imagine having, if I were in that place, I think I'd be always doubting which decision I made. And that's got to be a horrible thing. And I think there should be counseling and things like that on the afterwards to kind of help them through that, because it's part of the healthcare system. So.
Pennsylvania has major educational funding issues. In the 7th District, we've got school districts like Upper Darby and William Penn that are fighting for any kind of funding whatsoever, while some of the others are almost like elite private schools with, you know, everything that they have, spending twice as much per student in some cases. You know, what would you want to do in Washington to kind of help eliminate that disparity between public school systems?
Okay. So let me start first is... not talk about the money in that debate, and I'll come back to that. One is our metrics for measuring students and how money is actually allocated at the federal levels are ancient, okay, in my opinion. They're absolutely ancient. They really have very little relevance today. It's all about, and I talk to teachers too, it's all about teaching kids how to take tests, okay, to get to college, okay. College is not the only answer to a pathway to economic security. Yes, in many ways, it probably was more so in past generations and maybe in my day, and I have a undergrad and a graduate degree. But in general, it's not the path to, you have people, young people coming out of college with maybe $100,000 in debt, and they can't get the job that is going to pay back that debt anytime soon, and they're burdened with debt right out of college. And really, it's hard for them to find good paying work on that. So I am, first of all, that whole process, the metrics of that have to be that has to be eliminated. Now, I'm not an educational expert, and I don't pretend to be one, but I know that's wrong. Okay, so we have to have metrics to measure the economic security. Okay, also that's one. So we have to get away from the thought of these metrics have to be just not once and done. It's about lifelong learning. And in IT, honestly, if you're not up to speed on and keep trained, you're not marketable after a very short period of time. That's the world, okay? It's right or wrong, like it or not, the world's changing fast. People have to, it's constant re-education.
Yeah, you're probably not using too much DOS at this point.
So. Yeah, that's true. So that's key. The skilled trades have been not talked about very much over the years. And that's absurd, in my opinion. So the metrics don't support skilled trades. You have separated schools. You have trade schools, technical high schools, and you have academic, quote unquote, high schools. I'll tell you, you know, that's ridiculous. These should be, we should get away from that system. There, you know, I look at models, I see other models that are out there. So, I'm not an education expert, but just one of the other thing I would actually do is we'd have to have some kind of summit or something to kind of bring people together in various educational, saying, what's our vision for this nation? Okay. One vision I have is we should be, it all starts with that. Okay. One vision could be, we should, in my opinion, one of the things, we should be the world leader in the design, development, and use of clean energy. Okay. So if that's a something we aspire to as a nation, we have to build our education system and the way we do. So I look at models like the robotics things that the Girl Scouts do and some of the organizations where they, in a community after school kind of perspective, they look at the, not just you go to one class, you're talking about robotics and you do everything around that, including they have the young people do welding. They have them do all, you know, wiring. They have them do the programming. They have to do the marketing, and they learn how to write. And so, to me, that's better education than the way we've done it. And so, to me, my three kids were all homeschooled. I went to public school. I'm not being critical of any, but it just opened my eyes to different ways of looking at education that we need to do. And I'm not going to say, and I don't agree, think that anything's one way is right or wrong. We have to look at new ways of thinking about education, what makes sense for young people, and then really build that new model. And so going back to your original question about them fighting over the money, well, yeah, they're going to fight. That's the model we have to fight over it. It's certainly inequitable. You don't want some groups to have, be less educated than others. That doesn't help anybody in this country. You want your neighbor to be your neighbor and your neighbor's children to be, even if you're highly educated, you want to have some basic, you want to make sure each of them has at least a basic education. That's always been our thing, culture in the United States, but we have a new world that we have, and we're staying back into an old agrarian, you know, from something that worked maybe, you know, right after with the baby boomers, and I'm at the tail end. So, but I mean, it worked with that, but it's not going to work for this generation. It will not work, and it will not work for this world, because we have to compete in a global environment. That's just the way it is. So overall we need some major reform, and it can start with the top in the federal government, say, like, stop this nonsense. And I think that's a practical thing that I could be would be involved with. It's like, and champion, like, get rid of the metrics, and then we'll have to think about, then everybody will be thinking about, well, how will we measure and how will we get our money? And then maybe we can make, and we have a good strategic plan on that. We can, over years, it's going to take, it's not going to happen overnight, we can get to where we need to be.
So kind of in closing, you know, this podcast is aimed at young Democrats in Delaware County. The ages we represent, it's up for debate, but it's 18 to 40, 18 to 42, depending on who you ask. Young.
Well, now I'm old. I'm the old category. I'm not now. Wow. My when I go in the senior centers, I'm a young guy.
So what issues do you think most Democrats, young Democrats, are concerned about in 2018?
What are they concerned about?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we're still a lot of concern in what I said earlier, economic security. I hear that all the time. Because when I say economic, that's just not the amount of what they're getting paid, which is problematic. Their rate, wages have been stagnant for older people. Well, I mean, when you redefine young Democrats, for a lot of those older upper end of the young Democrats, wages have been very stagnant over the last 8 to 10 years. So, but their costs continue to go up. Healthcare costs in particular keep going up. And then they have their burden with debt that a lot of people, you know, I had debt, yes, but not to the extent a lot of people do. So when you look at the net result, that's problematic for a lot of young people today. I think a lot of people are worried, concerned, and rightfully so, about injustice and other things that are happening in the world. But I sometimes listen, when I listen to my children, I was like, wow, it's like, you're concerned. I didn't realize that was a concern again, because it's been radically changed since I was a kid. and being called, you know, certain names for having black friends. You know, I'm like, wow, I don't see it. You know, but so to me, it's important for me to go and listen to. And I hear that that's concerning. We need to keep. So to me, there's always about another group that's going to be discriminated against. And I think that's in a large part human nature. We can't get away. We as humans can't get away from millennia of we just can't get away. This is, we have to recognize that this is a limitation of just being human. And we have to say the next group that, you know, there'll be some other group that comes in that says, we can't discriminate against them. We can't say that's the other group coming in. We have to be embracing of that. Whether now it's, you talk a lot, it used to be Mexican immigrants. A lot of times now it's refugees. You know, it's another group we have to be constantly socially aware and really be proponents of justice, no matter who they are, whether we like them or not. If it's all of a sudden it's Republicans that become them, you know, the endangered. You know, we have to be concerned. We have to be reaching out to them. We have to be making sure that their lives are good. So I think those are really the two biggest things: injustice and education and the economy, I think, are typically, certainly the environment too. I look at it as, and I've been doing this for a while, I've solar panels, electric panels, solar hot water that powers the electric car, which just happened to be, I hit a big pothole the other day and it just died.
Oh, geez.
But anyway, we got to fix our infrastructure. There was a good pick. I didn't realize at the time. I was like, there's a good thing in the infrastructure is crumbling because I was fortunate the person in front of me broke their axle.
Oh,
so, so I got off a little bit better. But, you know, the environment's important because I looked at, and, you know, honestly, and I don't know how many are concerned about. To me, if I were young, I'll tell you what you should be concerned about, the younger. I'll say the low end of the young Democrats and even below, you know, is the environment. Okay. I've sat in these by professionals from, you know, from NOAA and other things with presentations. I look at 2080 and the way the data is going on this, it's frightening. I'm frightened for my children. I'm frightened for everybody's children. I'm frightened for the young people. I'm going to be gone. I think I'll have it by that time. No, I'm not going to make it to, you know, something miracle drug comes along maybe, but I may be too exhausted anyway. But you know, I won't be around, but I fear for that. I really fear for that. And to me, it takes leadership. So to me, if you look at clean energy, okay. One is, what now? Maybe some people like they're. If you look at, you need it's. It seems to be common sense, but the people don't take it that way. Sometimes you need clean water, you need clean air, you need clean land. That helps with health. The better that is, the more healthy the population will be, less the healthcare costs will be. You look at the technology. If we say we're losing already. And it's quick. You see how fast we're losing credibility in the world. We should be declaring that we need to be number one. Oh, I'm sorry. I broke the rule here. I got super passionate and I started flailing my, banging the tables here in passion.
We like enthusiasm.
And messing up the mics here. But, you know, it's about, you have to be, we're going to be, and we have to take pride of that. We have to own it. And we have to put our education around it. We have to live it. And we have to be out there doing it, because right now you see what China's doing. They're going to be ahead of us. I like the announcement of Ford is going to. I don't want us like China announces. Nothing against China, but you know, they should be announcing things after we're announcing. Ford should have announced their, you know, going into electric trucks far before, probably 2 years before China's saying that all they're going to have electric vehicles by a certain time. You know, we need to be, that's, Americans are good at, you know, people say, and I find this from traveling for business, and I'm mostly Europe, they have an expression over in Europe, and it's in different languages, but the same expression. American, we do things because that's the way they've always been done. Americans do things because they've never been done before, okay? So that's why a lot of times they don't like us, and especially me. They don't like me to come over, but they realize they're getting, you know, we need a different perspective on things that works. So it's in our genes. It's in our genes. People came over here risk takers. They did. Even the people coming today will go at great risks, even far maybe than some of our ancestors, to get to this country. They're coming here for a better life. They're hard workers. They're there just kind of, we have the drive. We have, and I hear this, and I believe it myself, we have invention, innovation, risk-taking, all these things. So why don't we embrace this as a, and we, and that part is being number, now when we talk about that manufacturing job, you know, well, you know, and coal mining, that's gone, you know, coal jobs are gone. Did you realize telegraph operator jobs have been gone for a while now? Okay. So, you know, we need to be thinking about what's next for us. Where are we going to, because we've been out in front. We're adventurers. We're clearly, it's an adventurous. We have these things that if we just embrace them and say, we're going to do that and we're going to learn from maybe, and we're going to learn from other countries. Certainly we should be doing that. Like in certain things that work well with in the healthcare and the, especially in the Scandinavian countries where, you know, we can learn from these things, but we need to, we can't be them. Let's just be ourselves, but learn from others. And that's why people want to keep coming. That's why my wife's an immigrant. That's why they come. And we're already here and it's in our genes. It happened. You know, it's like, they went through the same thing 10, 15, 100, 200, 300 years ago. That drive has not changed. So if we focus on that and we do it on clean energy, we all stand to win, everybody. We can have better paying jobs. We can have cleaner, we can have better more healthy, and we can and we can just make our whole country better. But we got to be out there in front.
Drew McGinty, thank you so much for joining us on the Delco Young Democast.
Thank you very much. You got me to the environment. I started pounding the table. I'm passionate about it all. And thank you very much for taking the time. I'm there, you know, to make a difference in the lives of all Americans. And I'm going to do that. I'm tenacious, and I'm coming up with new and creative ways and really to show people that there's a better way of doing things. And I'm hopefully, you know, if nothing else, I hope people start seeing this on every side. And if I can make a small difference, I'll be eternally grateful. And I'll have a clean conscience. All right. Thank you all. All
right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you all for listening to the Delco Young Democast once again. We really appreciate it. We want to give a shout out to the band Tin Mouth for letting us use their song Generation to Generation as the theme song to our show. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You can rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcatcher you like. You can tell your friends. Please let us know you're out there. Please let us know if you're enjoying the show. My email is mike@delcoyoungdemocast.com. One more time, thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.